As Mr. Slocum said last night, several of us were over with the young adults at Rachel's house. We had a nice dinner and then a Bible study afterwards. And several weeks ago, they had basically picked the subject that they wanted to talk about. And basically, they said, we want to talk about 1 Peter 2:13 through 25. And today, that's the same topic that I want to speak about. It's actually, before the study, I was telling Mr. Slocum that I was planning on speaking on this today, and he, somewhat jokingly, he said, "Oh yeah, you can only study one subject at a time," and that's partially true. I'll be completely honest and admit that. But also, it was interesting because, probably starting a month ago or so, I started thinking about what I would talk about, and I had several subjects in mind, and I was kind of toying about which one I would give, and then when the young adults sent this one over, like, I started thinking about it, and thinking about it more and more, and meditating and studying, and it became one of those things where it started to consume basically all that I was thinking about. And so it was like very hard, and whether that was my lack of ability or God working through me, it became very hard to think about anything else. And so that's what I want to look at today. And so if you turn there, it's 1 Peter 2:13 through 25, what you'll see, at least in my Bible here, it has two headings in this section. It says submission to government and submission to masters. And then I have another New King James Bible at home, and it just has one label over the whole section, and it says submission to authority. And as I was saying, as I read this and kind of started thinking about, how what I might contribute to the Bible study, it started to consume more and more of my thoughts. And, as I read it and I thought about it and studied other parts of this submission to authority, it's one of those subjects that, while it can be touchy and we don't talk about it all that often, it's actually very valuable for each and every one of us. Because if you think about it, there's only one being in the entire creation that is not under authority in some way. You can say we have a hierarchy and you might be under less authority, more authority. At work, a lot of people will talk about how many levels they're below the CEO, right? And, sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less. And so that's mentally how we think about it. But realistically, as I say, only God the Father is not under some form of authority. Every other being, every other human in creation is under some type of authority. Now, you might be in authority in some places and under authority in others. And how it often works is, sometimes you might be in authority in one place, but under authority in another place. And this is, essentially how God set it up. As I say, as we'll start to look through this, it's something that understanding godly approach to submitting to authority is key for each and every one of us. It's something that we all have to learn, and it's, if you think about it, it's actually something that you have to practice. It's not something that you're going to get right the first time. It's something where the more that you do it, the more that you do it in the way that God explains to do it, the better you'll get at it. And the better that you get at it, the easier it becomes. And, we can, often think that this might be a subject for those that are youngest among us. And, I think it was great of the young adults to pick this subject to talk about, because it is critical for, the youngest among us. But as I say, it's critical for each and every one of us, and it's going to be critical for all eternity. And it is something where if you pick up the right habits, if you understand what God says the approach should be, it becomes easier throughout your life. But if you don't, it's something that you'll never be good at, that you'll never be able to do in the right way. And so, when we look at this, this shouldn't be something where it's, very much from the top down, that authority is telling you the way that you should be. And we'll look at it because, when you think about authority as an entire subject, there's two sides to authority. There's being in authority, so the one that has some type of authority, And then there's being under authority. And when you look at it and how God talks about it, he separates those into two separate topics. Because it's very easy when you're, let's say, in authority to want to tell those who are under authority how they should behave when you, you know, exert your authority. But when you're under authority, it's very easy to also do the opposite of saying, you know, I don't have to obey this authority or I don't have to submit because they're not doing it the way that I think they should do it. And so what you see and hear today, I'll only talk about the subject of being under authority, but what you'll see is God, in how he tells us to submit to authority, doesn't ever talk about, or actually talks about, but in a very negative way, all the authority that you should submit yourself to. So he separates those, and he basically says that, you know, when you have to submit to authority, when you're under authority, it's independent of who's above you, of what authority is. And when you're over authority, it's much the same way, that you are supposed to act in a godly way, independent of how those are underneath you. And so it's very important to think about it in a very personal approach, a very personal way, that this is going to be your approach, that following God's way is going to be your approach, regardless of what those above you do, regardless of how they act, how they respond to you, how they treat you. And so it is something where it's not necessarily, very tops down. This is God telling each and every one of us what he expects. And he lays it out very clearly and gives us many examples that we can follow through. And one of the interesting points, and I hadn't thought about it until last night, but I think it's very applicable here. Actually, Keith was the one, I believe, who mentioned this, is fundamentally, if you think about it, authority, and especially submitting to authority, is like every other commandment in the Bible. It's centered on the two great commandments. Love God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And when you frame it under that, like so many of the commandments, it becomes much easier to understand what we should do and why we should do it. Because when you look at it, you know, God says clearly that he frames everything that he says, everything that we are to do, under these two commandments. But often we lose track of that framing. And so we go into a subject and we think about it independent. But as, you know, as God says, these are the key things that you have to keep in mind when you look at what he's explaining, what you look at what he's commanding you to do. And so before I go in, I want to look, you know, what does it mean, or why is authority tied to these two great commandments? And especially in the case when you might have to submit to ungodly authority, right? Because it's very easy to start losing track and saying, oh, that person is not doing the way that I think they should, or the way that God would want them to do, and then to start disconnecting yourself from authority. But when you look at it, it's very straightforward how, for the first one, how authority or submission to authority relates to loving God. We'll read just quickly. It's in Romans 13, 1 and 2. In Romans 13, 1 and 2, it says, "Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves." Right? These verses make it very clear, right? Because what does God say? You are to show your love for him by obeying his commandments. And he says here clearly that there's no authority, godly or ungodly, that exists except for by his will. And if you oppose that authority, you oppose his ordinances or his laws. You oppose him. And so, you know, you fit those two scriptures together, and it's very clear that there's no way that you can show your love to God, that you can follow through on that greatest of the commandments if you deny the authority of someone that God put in charge. And again, you know, as we'll look through in Peter, God doesn't say he always puts godly people in charge. You know, we know many examples. Nebuchadnezzar, all the kings of Israel, many of the kings of Judah. You can think about Saul. You can think about many men that God put in place in the Bible. And he was very clear that he put them in place. Cyrus, that it was clear he put them in place, and these were not godly men. But here he's saying, you know, in Romans, that no one is in authority unless he allows it. And so if you deny that authority, even if it's ungodly authority, you're denying the authority of God. You're denying that he knows what he's doing. You're denying that he has a plan that will ultimately get you into the kingdom. And so, as I say, you know, it's very clear that there's no way that you can be unsubmissive to authority without showing, you know, the lack of love that you have for God. And the second one of loving your neighbor might be a little bit less straightforward, but I think it's still very applicable if you think about it. No, because those who are in authority have been given, yes, authority, but they've also been given a responsibility. And, you know, if you think back to any of the most recent presidents, you know, if you think about President Clinton or President Bush or President Obama, think about, you know, especially towards the end of their terms, what would the media always show? They would show these before or after pictures, right? Like the picture that they had just as they were coming into office, and then the picture as they were leaving office. And you look at every one of them. Yeah, for those three, they were all, you know, fairly young men, or not so old as they entered the presidency. But as they came out, they didn't age just 8 years. They all aged, you know, 15, 20 years in that period of time. And, you know, you can argue and debate how godly or ungodly any of those three were. But regardless, the responsibility that they bore in that position of authority was a great burden, was a great weight. And you could see physically how it wore on them, physically how much it affected them. And so if you think about that, you know, what is a way that you can, as someone under authority, help that person that's in authority? By acting in a godly manner, regardless of what they do. Right? And even if you think about within the church, right? Those who are, you know, in authority, while they might, you know, not always show a godly approach, while they're still learning, as we all have to throughout our lives, what being in authority in a godly manner means, we can also help them by always responding in a godly way, always submitting in a godly way. And if you think about it, there's, in this case, because we all at some point end up being in authority of some, you know, some amount, there's no, you know, easier way to show the golden rule than this, right? It says, therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets, right? And if you think about it, when you're under authority, or when you're in authority, what do you want people to do? You want them to submit to you in a godly way. And so if you want somebody to submit to you in a godly way, what should be your focus when you're under authority? Submitting in a godly way. And we'll get into the details of submitting into the godly way, because it's more nuanced than what you might think. Because, and we'll read Peter, and it's very clear what God expects of us, but we'll also look through examples where it might not be as straightforward, you know, as you think, because often when we think about submitting to authority, we actually think about it not in a godly way. We think about it very much in a ungodly way, actually how Satan wants us to submit to authority. And so we'll go through what it means to submit to authority. But with that interview, or with that overview, let's pick up in Peter. This is 1 Peter chapter 2. And I actually want to start at the very end of this section of verses in 1 Peter 2:25, because what we see at the very end of these verses is God actually explains why submitting to authority is so important. And so if we see 1 Peter 2:25, it says, for you were like sheep going astray, but have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. You know, so think about what Peter's saying here. Again, this whole section, beginning in verse 13 and even a little bit above in verses 11 and 12, it has some connection to this. This whole section is talking about submission to authority. And God ends it, or Peter ends it, saying that you were like sheep going astray, but now you've returned. Right? So, you know, essentially, you know, in maybe more straightforward English, what he's saying is you didn't understand the proper reason or the proper way of submitting to authority. And when you didn't, you separated yourself from God. You separated yourself from Christ. You separated yourself from his family, right? Often this symbol of a flock of sheep and the shepherd is exactly talking about the church, God's people, and then Christ as that shepherd. So what he's saying is, when you didn't understand this, when you didn't do this, you separated yourself from the family of God, from God himself. But now that you understand it, now that you're going to go out and do it, now you've returned. You've been brought back into the family. And this is very much, when you think about submission, godly submission to authority, and I do want to kind of continue to emphasize that, because it's not just submission to authority. As we'll talk about, there's right ways and wrong ways. But in the godly way, it brings people together. And there's many verses where God lays out the reason why he has authority. You know, the reasons why you pray for, you know, it says the kings and the governors, is so that there's peace, so that there's unity, so that there's harmony. And so God is very clear about why this is important. And so if you think about it, you know, when you don't follow, when you don't submit yourself in a godly way to authority, you're separating yourself from his protection. He just can't protect you, right? You're going off as that sheep away from everyone else. And so submitting to authority is a requirement to be in the family of God. If you want to be part of that flock, if you want to be part of his family, you have to learn this. As I said, it's not something that you just poof, magically, you know, figure out how to do it. This is something that God expects you to practice. God expects you to learn over your life how to do it. Right? And it might be very easy to say that, you know, in eternity, I'm going to all of a sudden be a spirit being, right? All of a sudden, there's not going to be any sin. There's not going to be anything bad going on. You know, it'll be easy to submit to authority. But is that really true? Because think about the first person who didn't submit themselves to God's authority. It was Lucifer. Right? There you have one of the, you know, most powerful angels, one of the most perfect beings that God ever created. And he lived for some period of time. You know, we don't know exactly how time works in the spirit realm, but there was a period that he lived under God's perfect authority, that there was no sin. There was nothing that he could justify not being submissive to. And not only that, he sat at the very throne of God. And what do we know about thrones, right? Beings come up to the throne and they get judgment. And so he sees, you know, how many millions of angels coming to God and getting perfect judgment. God showing how to exercise authority in a perfect way. He's sitting there and seeing this. You know, how many times did he see it? But there became a point where he decided that instead of submitting to God's authority, he wanted to be that ultimate authority. He wanted to be the one that was in authority. He didn't want to be under authority anymore. And so you think about it, it might not be as easy as what we think to submit to God's authority for all eternity. But that's what he expects, right? He won't let us be in his kingdom. He won't let us be part of his family if we're not able to submit to him 100% for all eternity. You know, and you might think about it even beyond that, because as we saw in Romans, aren't we living under God's perfect authority today? Yes, there's sin in the world. Yes, there's bad things that happen. But God was very clear. We're under his perfect authority today. You know, and I'll be the first to admit, there have been more than once when I thought God was wrong, that I wouldn't have done the thing that I, you know, wouldn't have wanted him to do the thing that he did. And yet I still have to submit myself. And this is speculation on my part, some, I believe, informed, and I'll talk about it in a bit, some informed speculation. But what I see in the Bible is there's a good chance in eternity we will disagree with God, that we will think, you know, some decision that he makes, that he should have made a different decision. And yet, we will still have to submit. And we'll see it's not as straightforward as that, because the Bible talks about how you can respectfully disagree, and we see examples of that. But ultimately, when God makes a decision, and that decision is final, for all eternity, we're always going to have to submit. And he, for the unity of his family, can't let you in, can't let you as an individual into his family if you aren't willing to submit, even when you might disagree with him, even when you think there's a better way. And this is how important it is, right? And as you think about it, this is exactly what Lucifer happened to. At some point, he decided he wasn't willing to submit, and we see everything that has happened since. The rebellion of the angels, sin entering, man, you know, having to go through this process, going through, you know, sinful process, or going through sin and then having to be redeemed by Christ to come back to his family. God's not going to let that happen again. And so if he's not 100% certain that that is not going to be you, he won't let you in. And of course, we know not to get down, because he knows that. He knows that, and he's working with you on that. He's working with each and every one of us with that. You know, and so, you know, when we think about it, it's a very important part of what we're learning in this life, that we're willing to submit even if we might disagree. So now let's pick it up in 1 Peter 2 and verse 13. It says, "Therefore, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or to governors as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who are good." And this is, you know, as I say, one of the key points made throughout this section of scriptures, that there's no justification for not submitting in a godly way to those that God has put into authority. And just, if you think about it, put yourself into Peter's shoes and into the shoes that of those he was writing to, who did they have to submit themselves to at this time? The Roman Empire. And I picked kind of four of the emperors that were right around this time, a couple that probably came right before this letter was written, and a few that came right after or during. But if you look through those four emperors, you get a very interesting view. So the first one is Claudius. So Claudius was an emperor, and what he was known for widely was killing many senators, right? And this is, if you know Roman history, this was only a couple of emperors into the empire after the Republic had been kind of overthrown. But the Senate was still a major power, and actually continued to be a major power for a long time, and actually overthrew several emperors. And so what this emperor was best known for was killing those people who were, you know, most likely to oppose his power. And if you think about it, we don't have any government officials that are anywhere near this. If you look at the next one, Vespasian, he was, as a Roman general, a few years before he became the emperor, he was the one who actually besieged and destroyed Jerusalem. So think about what Peter's saying. You have to submit yourself to an emperor who just destroyed the holy city. That's what he's saying in this context. And again, you know, we don't have anything nearly like that today. Another one is Caligula. And he was an emperor who was widely known for his cruelty, for his extravagance, for his, you know, wanton killing of people. Another one was Nero. You know, I'm sure Nero is one that many people have heard about, but he was an emperor who killed his mother while he was an emperor. He killed his first wife because she couldn't give him a male heir. He was also widely thought to have started a fire that burned much of Rome. And then after that, he blamed the Christians for starting that fire, and he started to round them up and throw them into, you know, into the lions and into the Colosseum. And so think about these four men that happened right around this letter of Peter. He's saying you have to submit yourself to men like that. You know, as bad or as good as what we have for our politicians today, none of them even compare to this. You know, and if any of them compared to this, they would, you know, instantly be put in jail, right? They would be impeached and put in jail. And so when we think about the time that we live in today, we have no excuse. Like, this is what Peter's making clear, is there is no excuse. You have to submit yourself even to men like this. And so going on, it says in 1 Peter 2:15, it says, "For this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. As free, yet not using liberty as a cloak for vice, and as bondservants of God." It says, "Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king." Again, he's saying, honor these men. Are these men, you know, have they done anything to justify honor at this time? You know, not even close. And so he's saying these things that in spite of those who are in authority over you, this is how I expect you to act. This is how God expects you to act. And so as I say, you know, there's a clear separation between you when you are under authority and how you're supposed to act, and how the person who's in authority is acting, regardless of how they act. You know, I don't think anybody, you know, even knows somebody that has gone to this level, and definitely no one that is in authority over you. And, you know, yes, it might feel painful when you have that boss who is, you know, doesn't really care about you, doesn't really care about how you're doing, doesn't care about, you know, making work a good place for you. It might seem painful, but it's nowhere near these four emperors. Or, you know, when you have someone, a parent, right, that you think is being cruel or not nice, it's again nowhere near these. And so there's really just no excuse. There's no justification that you can have for not submitting yourself in a godly way to authority. And so if we go on, It says in 1 Peter 2:18, "Servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh." Right? So again, there's no excuse. "For this is commendable, if because of conscience towards God one endures grief, suffering wrongfully, for what credit is it if when you are beaten for your faults you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God." And so God is holding out, you can think of as a carrot. He says, if you do the right thing and, you know, you suffer for it, I'll remember it. I'll commend you. Right? And we know in other places he says, I'll reward you for it. He says, just trust me. Suffer, do good, and then I'll reward you. And that reward will be greater than anything that you might feel by getting back at that person, or, you know, complaining about that person or criticizing about that person. But you have to trust them. You have to trust that that reward is going to be worth it. But this is what God is, you know, or what Peter is saying here. He's saying, you know, anyone can, you know, when you're beaten for your faults, take it patiently. But what I'm expecting is you to take it patiently when you do good. When you submit in a godly way to somebody and that person exercises ungodly authority over you, God says that's good. He commends you for it. Because if you think about it, what better way to practice submission to godly authority than being able to continue to submit even when it's not godly? Right? Lucifer had a long time to practice submitting to godly authority and he ended up failing. What God is saying here is, I'm giving you an opportunity to submit yourself in a godly way to ungodly authority. And when you then have to live for all eternity under my authority, you're not going to have a problem with it. You're going to remember what it was like to submit yourself to ungodly authority. You're going to remember the practice that you had, the things that you did, and then you're going to think this is a breeze. And it's going to be so easy, you're going to do it for all eternity. You know, this is what Peter is saying here. So it goes on in verse 21, it says, "For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges rightly, who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed." You know, so reading these verses, and I'll say many, and especially those who tend to be in authority, exercising ungodly authority, will say that you have to submit, never questioning or never disagreeing with authority. But as we'll see, this is actually biblically clearly untrue, because submission is not the same as agreement. You know, for those who are parents, how many times have, you know, you told your children, you know, I'll say for our kids, it's complaining about food, you know, not wanting to eat this, not, I don't like this, right? It's kind of a very common thing that we hear at the dinner table. And what do we often tell them? It's okay to not like it. Just do it anyway. Right? I told you to do it. Just do it anyway. And again, you know, hopefully in many cases, the reason why we're telling you to do it anyway is we're saying, go eat healthy food that will long-term make your body healthy and strong and make you not sick and all these things. But that's not what they're thinking at the time. They're thinking, I don't like the flavor of this. I don't like the texture of this. I don't like the smell of this. You know, whatever it is, whatever reason why they don't want to eat. But again, you know, even in that conversation with children, basically what we're saying is, it's okay to not like that food. It's okay to not want to eat it. But you have to go on and eat it anyway, because that's what I told you to do. And again, you know, in many cases, it's because we're doing it for their own good. But again, this is not what we just read in 1 Peter, right? He said, you're to do it even if it's not for your own good. In fact, it's commendable when you do it when it's not for your own good. But again, when we're talking about godly submission to authority, it's different than wanting to do it or not. It's different than agreeing. And it's actually even different than discussing it. Those are three entirely separate things which you can all do in a godly way. The key thing, though, is when that person in authority or that being in authority says, I've made my final decision, you go and do it. Even if you don't want to. Even if you don't like to. And in some cases, even if it's not good for you. Now, there are some cases, and we'll look at those, where, you know, when we're talking about submitting to authority, we don't want to essentially end up into either ditch, right? Because there are two ditches, right? The first, and I would say probably the most common, is we resist authority, right? We don't like people telling us what to do. We want to do what we want, when we want, and that's part of human nature. But the other thing is that we also have to make sure we don't blindly follow authority, especially ungodly authority. But as we go through these examples that we'll start to look at, you know, we have to be careful that we're not going to either ditch, that we're not resisting authority just because we don't want to do it, but also that we're not blindly following authority. And in particular, the Bible gives many examples of not blindly following authority when it's contrary to God's way. And that's really the one specific place where you're allowed to not submit yourself to authority, but it's only within certain parameters. Because think about the example of Daniel in the lion's den. Think about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Think about what they did before and after them not submitting to authority. You know, in the case of Daniel, he was one of the most trusted advisors, both before and after. He submitted to an ungodly king before and after. He did what he was told. He was, you know, put second in charge because he was so good at it. But when he was told not to pray to God, not to follow God's laws, that one instance is when he didn't submit himself to authority. The same for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We see the same thing. They submitted themselves into authority all the way up until the point where they were told to bow down and clearly break one of God's laws. And afterwards, they went back to obeying. So there's very strict bounds. And we also have many examples of Christ. And this is another one that we talked about last night, where he contended very, very strongly with the Pharisees and Sadducees. But he was also clear that they were in authority. But we learn something in Peter's letter, which is critical with how we deal with ungodly authority. And so, as I say, the first way is when it's very clear and very tactically you're told to, you know, disobey one of God's laws. That's the first one. The second one is a bit more indirect, but we see this in 1 Peter 2:23. I'll read it again. It says, talking about Christ, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. Because what you see is Christ only resisted the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and sometimes in very public ways and in, you know, fairly rude ways. They were called vipers and, you know, all kinds of things, or you might say rude ways. But it was only when they were leading other people away from God's law and when they were bringing dishonor to the name of God the Father. That was the only time that he did it. Because other than that, when it affected him personally, when it was just against him as a man, it says he didn't revile back. He didn't, you know, threaten. He just committed himself because he knew that ultimately God was the one that put these men into authority and that God was working out a bigger purpose, a bigger plan. And he very clearly said that these men were in authority. It says in Matthew 23, verse 2, it says, "The teachers of religious law and the Pharisees are the official interpreters of the law of Moses. So practice and obey whatever they tell you." Right? He was telling his followers to practice and obey them. But then it goes on and he says, "But don't follow their example, for they don't practice what they teach." Right? He said, do what they say, because what they say is right, but just don't do what they do. And a lot of times, you know, what the people at that time would do is they would not follow what the Pharisees were saying. They would follow what the Pharisees were doing. They were modeling themselves after those in authority. So those are two very clear cases where you cannot submit to authority. But there's also a little bit of a grayer area. And that's when, you know, what do you do when you disagree with someone in authority, but it's not contrary to God's law? Like, do you just automatically submit? Do you do whatever that person says? Do you not, you know, tell them what you think? And the clear biblical answer is no. You can talk to somebody in authority. You can tell them what you think. But there's very careful ways that you have to tread in these situations, because it's highly dependent on the approach that you take and the attitude that you have, whether it's godly or not. Because it's, you know, very easy to work yourself up into a state where you disagree and you can, you know, think that that person is doing something in an ungodly way, or that you can justify to yourself that you're not going to submit because it's against God, or that you can come to them in a very disrespectful way. And God is clear that that is not the way to do it. I'll just give a couple of quick examples here. The first is Christ himself. We see in Matthew 26, 36, and kind of on through 46, and I won't read all this because we know this story well. This is Christ at the Garden of Gethsemane. And here it's right before his crucifixion. And we'll read in verse 39, this is Matthew 26, verse 39. It says, he went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed, saying, "Oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you." And then dropping down in verse 42, it says, again, a second time he went away and prayed, saying, "Oh, my Father, if this cup cannot pass away from me unless I drink it, your will be done." And then in verse 44, it says, so he left them, went away again, and prayed the third time, saying the same words. And so what do we see here? That in this time, in this instance, Christ actually kind of disagreed with the Father. He was like, I don't really want to do this. Like, let's find another way. Now, I know we've been talking about this for a long time. I know this is what I need to do, but come on, there has to be another way. Like, now that I'm right here, I want to do something different. And, you know, you can see the intensity with which he prayed. And it says, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. You know, this is how deeply he wanted a different way. He didn't want to die at this point. He knew it was needed, and he went through and he did it. But, you know, here he is asking God in a godly manner, you know, is there another way? I'll submit to your authority, God, but let's find another way if it's possible. And so as I say, you know, you can start with Christ and see that there are times, even when they're in perfect unity, perfect harmony together, that Christ wanted something else than what God the Father told him to do. And yet he did it anyway, and he did it unto death. Right? That's the example that we have to follow. Like, and again, he's under perfect godly authority, but he still wanted something else. What he wanted and what God the Father wanted for that particular instance were different. But of course, they wanted something bigger together too. And that's what ultimately led Christ to go on and to submit himself. But again, we will start to see in a number of these other examples where it's not wrong to want something different to God. But there's a way that you go about it. And the key thing is that when God says, I'm done, that's my final decision, you move on and you do it. The second one is Paul. This is in 2 Corinthians, and we'll just read verses here. This is 2 Corinthians 12, verse 7. And this, you know, if we remember this this section, basically Paul is talking about, you know, himself. He's talking about himself. And so here in verse 7, it says, unless I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelation, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord three times. Again, this three times. Now, we'll see another example where actually someone discusses things more than three times with God. But it starts to show that, you know, it's not just you go to God once, you don't give the answer, you don't go back to him. No, you can go back to him multiple times. You know, if you think about three times, it means like you went once, you got the answer you didn't like, you got another time, you're like, oh, really, I want a different answer. You go back a third time, but then you say, okay, I have that final answer. I know what God wants, and I'm going to go do it. Right, and so here, you know, we see that the way that both Paul and Christ handled it is they weren't afraid to express their wants and desires to God. They weren't afraid to say they want something different, that, you know, you could say that they disagreed with him in this particular instance. I'm sure as Paul was going through this, he thought, you know, God, I think it'll really be better for you if you take this thorn away. You know, how much better of a minister will I be? How many more people will I be able to preach to? He really believed it, I'm sure. But once he heard that final answer, once he knew God wasn't changing his mind, he let it go. And then at some point later, he understood why God decided what he did. But again, you know, we can't expect that God's always going to reveal immediately why he did it a particular way. Sometimes we just, you know, as we tell our children, just do it because I said, right? Just because God said to do it, just do it. Another example is Abraham. We know this. I won't read this whole thing, but when Abraham intercedes with Sodom, right? We know the story, and this is Genesis 18, kind of 23 through 33. God comes to Abraham, and he says, I'm going to destroy Sodom. And then what you see is you see Abraham, and this is one of those where for a long time I always thought this was very funny, because here it is, you know, Abraham's negotiating with God. And he's negotiating in a way where, you know, I don't know what God thought, but like as a parent, you know, you have children that negotiate in this way, and you're like, really, come on, like how many times are you going to come back and ask the same thing, like slightly less? But we see here in verse 23, it says, and Abraham came near and said, would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? And again, this is actually a key point that we'll see in other places, because when you talk to God, when you disagree with God, you have to be very sure that the thing that you're disagreeing about or the way that you're proposing is still acceptable in God's way, right? Because he says, you know, would you destroy the righteous with the wicked? And we know many other places where God is very clear that, you know, he's going to protect the righteous even when there's wicked around them. And so, you know, this is a you know, you could say a biblical argument that he's bringing to God. And he says, suppose there were 50. And then he, you know, goes again and he says, indeed now, who am I but dust? This is in verse 27. And ashes, but have taken it upon myself to speak to the Lord. So this is another important part. When you disagree with God, you have to go in a very humble spirit. You can't, you know, go in a spirit of, I know the best thing. I know, you know, what it should be. You don't understand what you're talking about. But it's not only to God, because these examples that we're looking about is a man going to God. But it's also, if you're going to go to someone in authority, again, godly, ungodly, someone who's, you know, mainly godly but doing something ungodly, or someone who's completely ungodly all the time, you have to go in a humble and respectful way. This is how God expects you to do it. And he goes on, suppose there were 5 less. And then, you know, he goes on, suppose there's 40. And then he goes on and he says, you know, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Suppose there's 30. You know, I'm sure the parents out there have experienced this one or twice where you're like, no, you can't do that. Well, what about like 30 minutes of TV time? No. 20? 25? Like, you know, and they keep the negotiation. And he keeps going all the way to verse 32. I think I count 6 different times in this one conversation he goes back to God and he says, consider something else. Like, I know this is what you said you're going to do, but consider something else. And again, we know the rest of the story, that God went and saved Lot and his family and destroyed Sodom. But again, this is a great example of how you can respectfully, in a godly way, submit to authority, but express your own view. And it's very important that you do this, because if you don't express what you want, what you desire, what you think to someone in authority, not only potentially is that person in authority, you know, not getting all the ideas, not getting all the thoughts, but it actually is harmful for you, because you start to hang on to these things. And this is where bitterness can often come in, right? Because you think nobody's listening to you. Well, sometimes nobody is listening to you because you're not telling anybody what you think. And that includes God. I mean, yes, God knows, but still you have to go to him. So another one, and again, this is another one that I've often thought about as it happens. And I won't read the whole thing again, but this is Moses with the golden calf. And so this is Exodus 32:7 through 14. And I won't read any scriptures here, but if you read it after the fact, what you see is, you know, Israel had created the golden calf. Moses is up on the mountain, and God comes to Moses and says, I'm done. I'm going to start again. I'm going to destroy the children of Israel, and I'm just going to start through you. And if he had done that, if God had done that, he wouldn't have sinned. He would have perfectly been within his right to go do that. But Moses didn't want that. Moses had a great affection for the people of Israel. Now, you see what he'd been through just from the time that he, you know, came back to this time. They had complained a lot. They had caused a lot of problems for Moses. But he still loved them as a people. And not just that, but he loved God. And he knew what God was ultimately doing. And this is how he talked to them. You know, it says in verse 9, it says, "And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and indeed it is stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone." Right? It's pretty clear. Like, Moses, I don't want to hear what you have to say. "Let me alone that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, and I will make you a great nation." I mean, think about this. So Moses is like, okay, it's not a bad deal. Like, all the people that have been complaining about me, like, don't like how I'm leading, are all gone. God does it, not me. And I get to be, like, the new Abraham. Right? You know, there's Abraham, but now there's Moses, the one person that starts the new children of Israel, you could say. But what do we see in verse 11? It says, "Then Moses pleaded with the Lord his God and said, Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak and say, he brought them out to harm them, to kill them in the mountains, and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce wrath and relent from this harm to your people. You know, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants." And so you see the way in which Moses is talking to God. And, you know, some say that God was testing Moses here. And maybe that's the case, but I don't actually think so. I actually think God had had enough, right? You look at that period from the time that he sent Moses back to now the golden calf, and it's very clear to God that these people at this time are not going to be a holy nation to him, are not going to obey him, and he was done. But Moses went and said, you know, there's a better way. Because if you go do this, and yes, you're within your rights to do this, what will the other nations think? They'll think less of you, God. You know, there's nothing wrong with what you're doing, but they'll think less of you. You know, and think about what you promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. You know, yes, it'll be done through me, but that's not really what you meant when you told them. Right? And so you think about what Moses is doing here with God. And again, I think this is another thing where in eternity, you know, there'll be times where we go to God and be like, you know, I know you think we should do this, but what about this? And there'll be times where God will say, you know what? That's actually a better idea. I'm going to go with that idea. And there'll be times where he says, nope, still going to do it my way. And you have to be willing to submit in both cases. And you have to always come in a respectful, humble way. But, you know, I think this one in particular stands out to me because it shows what God is really doing with his family. He's not there for all eternity to just imprint his way of doing things. He actually wants us to be part of his family because what we're going to bring, the diversity of our experiences, the ideas that we have, paired with the Holy Spirit and being in the spiritual realm, will be so much greater than what he and Christ could have done alone. You know, think about that. That is what God is excited about, that we are actually going to make God and Christ better than what they would have been all alone. And we see, you know, this example. Because, you know, think about if we would have read in Exodus, you know, 15, where God had sent, you know, fire and brimstone and destroyed the people of Israel. What would we have thought? We'd have thought, you know, he was well within his rights, but that was, you know, pretty harsh thing to do. As opposed to here, we see that God was merciful and that we can talk to him and we can, you know, help shift what he's thinking. Because he's always going to focus on justice, mercy, but he can shift between them. And we actually have that opportunity to help him think about other perspectives. The last one, and I won't read it, but I'll just mention it because it's similar to Paul, and that's King Hezekiah, right? In 2 Kings 20, verse 1, God sends a prophet, sends Isaiah to Hezekiah, and he says, you know, set your house in order, you're going to die. And what did Hezekiah do? We all know. He instantly fell down, he said a prayer, and before, and it says, then he, it says, and it happened before Isaiah had gone out into the middle court. You know, this is a, I'm not sure how big the palace was, but, you know, he hadn't probably gone 10, 15 minutes, maybe. And God sends Isaiah back in and he says, because you prayed, I've changed my mind. You know, and again, yes, like maybe he was testing Hezekiah, but I don't know. You know, if Hezekiah wouldn't have prayed, would he have decided, oh, I was just kind of joking and I'll let you live? No, he had made up his mind for whatever reason that Hezekiah was going to die. And whatever Hezekiah said in that prayer made God change his mind. You know, Paul, he didn't change his mind. But Hezekiah prayed and he changed his mind. And so again, the way that Hezekiah, and you can read what he prayed, the way Hezekiah went to God was important. But just as important would have been if Hezekiah had made that prayer and God said, I hear your prayer, but you're still going to die. You know, would Hezekiah have submitted? And this is my guess, that God was pretty confident that Hezekiah would have submitted to him. And that was part of the reason why when he heard his prayer, he was willing to let him live. He knew what was in Hezekiah's heart. You know, he knew that Hezekiah had been following him. He knew that if, you know, he had prayed that prayer and was still given the answer that it was going to happen, that he wouldn't have separated himself from God. But these are the things that we see in the Bible of how we submit to authority. Because in all of these examples, these men submitted to authority in a godly way, and in every case, they disagreed with what God originally had said. Sometimes God changed his mind, sometimes he didn't. Sometimes he partially changed it, sometimes he completely changed it. But this is what we talk about when we talk about godly authority. It's not blindly doing what someone says. It's not not having an opinion. It's not expressing your opinion. It's about expressing your opinion, telling what you say in a respectful and a humble way, and then be willing to go do what that person in authority says, even if it's not what you want, even if it comes out in a harmful way for you. And I'll keep going fast here, but a few examples of the wrong way. The first one is in 2 Kings 5:15, Gehazi's greed. And if we remember this, this is now I'm blanking. I think it was Elisha, maybe Elijah. I think Elisha had healed the general by telling him to go into the Jordan to cleanse his leprosy, and the general had said, you know, I'll give you whatever you want. And I think it was Elisha. Now I'm Elijah, just too close. You know, said, I don't want anything from you. Just go and know that the Lord healed you. And then his servant went after, got money, and kind of made up a story. And so, you know, you can imagine that he's like, you know, you just did this thing. He's an enemy of Israel. Like, why would you let him go without giving anything to us? You can think of all the justifications that he was rattling in his mind. But the key thing here is that we have to examine our motives. You know, whereas Christ only kind of rebelled against or pushed against authority when it was outward, when it was that authority going against, you know, dishonoring God or taking people away from God, never when it was on himself. Here, you know, Gehazi had a very greedy perspective. Like, he wanted that money for himself if it wasn't going to go to somewhere else. And so we have to be very careful about our motives, because it's easy to justify ourselves, you know, in our own heads, that we're doing it for the right reasons. Another example is Aaron and Miriam opposing Moses. This is in Numbers 12. And here, you know, it says, while they were at Hazoth, Miriam and Aaron criticized Moses because he had married a Cushite woman. So, you know, they probably were arguing that he had done the wrong thing, that he had disobeyed God, or that wasn't, you know, taken someone outside of the people of Israel as a wife. And they go on and they say, has the Lord spoken only through Moses? Hasn't he spoken through us? But the Lord heard them. And so they were taking on more authority than they really had. You know, did they have authority? Yes. You know, they had miracles done through them. You know, Aaron was the high priest, but God was very clear that they were to submit themselves to Moses. And here they are questioning Moses. And it's interesting in verse 3, because he writes about it. It says, now Moses was very humble, more humble than any other person on earth. So if you think about it, you know, what do you want in somebody who's an authority over you? You want somebody that's humble. And here God's saying, like, Moses, you know, there was no one else that was more humble than Moses, but Miriam and Aaron still weren't willing to submit themselves, in this case, to Moses, even though he was the most humble person in the world at the time. And we see this time and time again. You know, I think it's interesting that you see Moses is probably the one leader who is rebelled against and complained about more than anyone else, and yet God said he's the most humble person at this time, right? And so here, you know, in some ways it's similar to Lucifer and God, you know, not exactly the same, but here they had a pretty good leader. They had somebody who was putting other people above himself, and they still weren't willing to submit. And God's response here was very immediate, right? He says in the next verse, so immediately the Lord called to Moses, Aaron and Miriam and said, go out to the tabernacle, all you three. And then we know that he eventually, or that right after, he cursed Miriam with leprosy, and that it was only because Moses intervened that was taken away. Another example with Moses, and I said, you know, as I said, it's interesting, I think, that Moses being this humble man that you would think would be, you know, about as good a human authority as you could get, probably had the, you know, most complaints, most rebellions against him, but Korah's rebellion. And again, this one's interesting because just like Miriam and Aaron, while they were in some level of authority, they were taking too much authority or more authority than they really had. Because if God didn't want Moses to marry that Cushite woman, God could have told him. You know, God was talking to him a lot. It wasn't like they didn't have a conversation going, you know, fairly regularly. So God knew what was going on, and he was the one that if he wanted it differently, he would have made it happen, right? He would have told Moses. He would have punished Moses. In fact, he ended up punishing Moses, you know, because he disobeyed. So it's not like God was unwilling to punish Moses. But they were setting themselves in between God and Moses, if you think about it, by taking on this authority. Korah is an interesting one because also, you know, Korah tries to take on too much authority. But it's interesting here, and I'll just read in Numbers 16, verse 3, it says, and they united against Moses and Aaron and said, you have gone too far. The whole community of Israel has been set apart by the Lord, and he is with all of us. What right do you have to act as though you are greater than the rest of the Lord's people? Well, that answer is pretty easy. God gave them that authority. God set them up as the one. And so, you know, if you think about it, kind of these three examples, having selfish motives, taking on too much authority, and accusing others of taking on more authority than they have, are three of the traps of, you know, justifying to yourself that you should be able to deny authority when you really shouldn't, when you should be submitting. And so as we think about it, you know, as I say, godly authority is, or submitting to godly authority is something that's nuanced, and it's something that's very personal, something that you have to think through, that you have to be sure about before you deny any authority. And really, because it's a personal thing, you, as the person who's under authority, actually shoulder the burden of, you know, kind of in the prosecutory sense, you shoulder the burden of being absolutely sure that you're, you know, denying authority only for a few select reasons. Because it's very easy to get in our heads and justify things that aren't true, or to, you know, say things, you know, because Korah really believed that Moses had no right. He really believed that he was on par with Moses, when any rational person who's reading after the fact is thinking, like, what were you thinking? God was very clear many, many times that Moses was the one in charge, that he had put Moses in that place of authority. But we as humans can get ourselves wrapped up thinking that, you know, we know better, that we should be the ones in authority, that we should be the ones deciding who are in authority. So, brethren, you know, as we see in Peter and in Romans and these other scriptures, being able to submit to authority with a godly approach. And that's the key thing. It's not submitting to authority in the way that mankind submits to authority. It's submitting in a godly approach. It's a critical skill for us. It's something that we have to learn, that we have to grow in as future sons and daughters of God the Father, right? And we have to learn and practice it in this life. And God gives us many opportunities. And without that, we will become lost. We will be that lost sheep, separated from God, separated from his family, and in danger of losing the most precious gift that we could get, which is eternal life. You know, submitting to authority, as I say, doesn't mean you don't disagree. Doesn't mean that you never want something different than that person in authority. But it means that, you know, when you go to them respectfully, you go to them humbly. But when they ultimately make their decision, you're willing to submit. You're willing to listen and put your wants and desires below theirs. Because even in this life, even when you're submitting to ungodly, you know, human authority, you're actually submitting to God. You're showing God that you're willing to submit to him. And that by showing him time and time again in this life, you're showing him that you're willing to do that for all eternity, that you're willing to be part of his family on the terms that he says you have to live by, and that ultimately you're showing him that you love him, with all of your heart, all of your soul, and all of your mind, and that you're worthy to be in his kingdom for all eternity.